Now stay tuned for the Sunday Morning Wake Up Call on 97.9 The Wren. The Wake Up Call talks with the people in Charlottesville and Albemarle County who are making a difference. Now here's your host, Rick Moore.
And welcome, everybody. Thank you so much for being here on another Sunday morning. This is the show I've been waiting to do for a long, long time. And we've got Andrew Ferguson and David Walsh here to help make it happen. They are UVA postdoctoral fellows. They teach a class on conspiracy theories at UVA. So, Andrew, how does UVA have a class on conspiracy theories?
Well, so David and I are part of a program that has been put in place for first-year students, so incoming new students at the University of Virginia, where we are teaching them about various areas of humanities inquiry, the sorts of things that they will be doing in a lot of the classes that they have at UVA. And it also gives them a chance to explore some things that they might not explore in the course of doing a chemistry major or something like that. So our class is technically in what they call the engaging ethics area. So our concern with the conspiracy theories is primarily ethical and how we respond to them, what these things are saying about the culture around us. And that's how we just decided to put it together as a subject that interested both of us and that we thought would be of interest to, you know, approximately the 70 students that we get each term for it. And so far it seems to be proving true.
Well, David, tell me, how did the two of you come together? Are you guys best friends outside of the classroom? Do you, do you attend some secret society together? How did the two of you shake hands and say, you know, let's get together and teach 70 students at a time on conspiracy theories?
Well, you know, I think originally we first met each other through Twitter, because we follow each other on Twitter, and then there were sort of more formal introductions when we were both hired by our current program. In the age of COVID, we've been able to get together occasionally. I've got a fire pit in my backyard, and we'll, you know, sit around the fire and talk and have a beer or two. And it sort of sprung forth organically. My background is I'm a historian. I'm actually currently writing a book about the sort of broader history of the far right in the United States and its relationship with American conservatism. And so obviously there's a lot of conspiracy theories and just paranoid thinking in the history of the American right. I mean, one of the chapters I'm working on right now actually is about the John Birch Society, which was sort of infamous in the 1950s and 1960s for believing all sorts of outlandish conspiracy theories. And so we were talking about this, and it just seemed like there was this sort of natural synergy in our interests. Andrew actually asked me, "Do you want to teach this class together?" I said, "Yes, that sounds like a great idea." And we've been doing it now for a little over a quarter. We're on a quarter system, so we're third week into our second quarter of the semester.
My interest in conspiracies is from it comes from English. My background is English literature, but I come to work more in digital studies, so basically weird internet stuff. And I'm very interested in conspiracies as narratives, how they develop, how we start to tell stories about them, and how they propagate and develop on the internet. So that's also a big part of it, is just being extremely online all the time and just seeing the weird things that people have to say on there. And I think that's again an interest that David and I certainly share.
Yeah. Did I mention we met on Twitter?
Yeah.
So let's start. There's always a lot of questions about conspiracy theories, and there's so many to get to within the hour as we talk with Andrew Ferguson and David Walsh. But I'm just going to pick one conspiracy theory to get a sample of how you guys do this in class. So let's start with that the United States never landed on the moon?
I think this is your one of your favorites, David.
Whenever you're talking about a conspiracy theory, it's always hard to know where to begin. Now, the conspiracy theory that the U.S. never landed on the moon, I think, I don't know how many of your listeners are familiar with this footage. We show it in class. But there is a very sort of dogged, or was about 15 years ago now, a dogged conspiracy theorist, although he's still around, named Bart Sabrell. There was a very infamous piece of footage that was circulating on YouTube where he, in a hotel, I think, in Florida, basically ambushed Buzz Aldrin, the second man on the moon, and started haranguing him as Buzz Aldrin was leaving his hotel, saying, "You never landed on the moon. How dare you? You're committing a fraud on the American public." And Aldrin just clocks him. He just punches him. And this is on camera. And so that's the footage that we used to open. We have an entire class dedicated to moon landing conspiracy theories. Now, what's interesting about the moon landing conspiracy theory is that it originates shortly after the end of the Apollo program, so roughly about 1975, 76. And you can trace the origins of it to a book by a guy named Bill Kaesring. I always forget how to pronounce it. But he wrote this book, the title of which, We Never Landed on the Moon, America's $30 Billion Hoax. And it was a self-published book. His background was that he was an electrical engineer who worked at a contractor that was involved in manufacturing machines for the Apollo program. I think it was North American. Might have been Northrop Grumman. And basically, his broad claim was that, you know, because of these sort of specific pieces of evidence that he points to, the shadows on the photographs from the moon, his sort of understanding of how technology develops, it was impossible for the Apollo program to land astronauts on the moon. Therefore, this must have been a government hoax. And the way that we always frame it in class is it really speaks to the sort of post-Watergate moment where there's this broad distrust of the U.S. government and all sorts of conspiracy theories that, you know, might not have sort of penetrated into the public consciousness 10 or 15 years earlier had this moment in sort of in the sun. So, obviously Watergate is going on, or, you know, Nixon resigns in 74, so it's over by 76. But this is also in the aftermath of the Church Committee, which is in a congressional committee, which was investigating all sorts of plots and programs by the CIA during the Cold War. It's also obviously after the Vietnam War and the various deceptions that the U.S. government propagated to justify and prolong the conflict in Southeast Asia. So that's one of the things we try to do is to think about conspiracy theories in historical context. When are they created? What's going on? How does that sort of inflect the dynamics of these theories? And in fact, in the Kaesring book, all of this is more or less explicit. He basically writes point blank as an introduction, Because of Watergate, we obviously can't trust the U.S. government. So therefore, what I'm saying makes more sense. And you see this reflected in the 70s in a lot of different pieces of popular culture. I actually think that there's a movie that nobody has ever seen. Well, not nobody. Obviously, it was released in the 70s, but it's a movie that has not stood the test of time. It's called Capricorn One. I don't know, Rick. Have you ever seen this movie?
I have not.
It stars Elliot Gould, Sam Waterston, Josh Brolin. I think O.J. Simpson is in it as one of the astronauts, and Hal Holbrook. And the whole plot of the movie is NASA fakes a landing, a manned landing on Mars. It was released in 1978. And basically the mission goes wrong, and, you know, it's originally supposed to be this manned Mars shot. The mission goes wrong, and therefore these astronauts are not actually sent up into space, but they're held on this, like, secret base in the middle of the desert, and they're threatened. Their families are threatened to be killed if they don't cooperate with NASA, because all of this has to happen because, you know, the contractors behind the program, like, need the money from the program, right? And eventually Elliot Gould, who plays this sort of investigative journalist, you know, exposes the whole thing. But that basic narrative dynamic is essentially it essentially maps on to what the moon landing conspiracy hoax theory becomes. And one of these things that you see when looking not just at this theory but many others is that there's this dynamic relationship between conspiracy theories and what's going on in popular culture, in movies, in TV, less so these days, but in print, certainly online these days. You know, the last thing I'll say, I've been going on about this for a while now, is that the moon landing conspiracy hoax kind of went away after the late 1970s. It was not really a big part of our culture, American culture, in the 80s and 90s. But it came roaring back in the early 2000s when Fox, not Fox News, Fox, the TV network, aired a TV special in 2001, basically saying that the moon landing was a hoax. And it was presented in this, like, oh, we're just asking questions, you know, why does this evidence not match up with what was presented to us by the U.S. government, that sort of thing. And that had a really, I think, profound impact on how this played out subsequently. I mean, Bart Sobrell would never have become the sort of quasi-celebrity, at least in conspiracy theory circles, that he became if it hadn't been for the kind of legitimacy that a major TV network gave his work in the early 2000s. You see this time and time again where you have media organizations, which are, you know, in theory supposed to be sort of these responsible arbiters of knowledge for the public, really failing on that score. And they get away with it by just, you know, using that framework of, oh, we're just asking questions, we're just poking holes in the official narrative, et cetera, et cetera. But that actually has really profound and unfortunate sort of social and political consequences.
So as we talk with David Walsh and Andrew Ferguson about conspiracy theories, Andrew, we were talking about the theory about U.S. never actually landing on the moon. What makes a conspiracy theory versus an urban legend?
Time, probably, or a certain number of people to decide that they're going to push forward with it or develop the narrative beyond just the urban legend, I guess.
So is there something that other people might identify as an urban legend that qualifies as conspiracy theory to you that makes your class? I'm not trying to put you in a weird place. I'm just trying to identify, like, I don't know if Loch Ness Monster or Bigfoot would qualify, but certainly there are others, some Bigfoot type monster in North Carolina that might be qualified as an urban legend. Is that not a conspiracy theory? The fact that so many people down there talk about it?
I think an urban legend, or you can think of urban legends and conspiracy theories as sort of sprouting off of the same base, which is partially examined prejudices and preconceptions that take particular forms depending on the culture that they're in. So if you have an urban legend, like, you know, sort of the super predators, or the sort of the old idea, like, oh, if you see somebody driving at night without their lights on, you know, don't flash your beams at them because they're going to, you know, it's a gang initiation. They're supposed to go kill the first person who flashes their lights at them. Which obviously has never happened, but it's just the same part of the, it comes from the same root of, you know, basically barely examined racism and pathologization of especially inner city life that leads to a great many conspiracy theories on, you know, a wide variety of things. But I think there are also things that can sound like urban legends going out, you know, going first. You know, probably a lot of the people who were being investigated by the CIA under COINTELPRO were thought, you know, when they started telling people, I think the CIA is like messing with me, they probably thought, no, you're just freaking out. That's an urban legend. The CIA doesn't care enough about us to mess with us on a personal basis. And we found out just how wrong that was, that they very much are into messing with people on a personal basis.
Yeah, I think that one of the distinguishing features between a conspiracy theory and an urban legend, although there's obviously a lot of overlap there, is its explanatory power. Rick, you mentioned a couple of cryptids, the Loch Ness Monster, for some reason the Jersey Devil just popped into my head. And, you know, those are the existence of the Loch Ness Monster doesn't necessarily explain anything. Or at the minimum, it doesn't provide a sort of neat explanation for a pressing social or political problem. You know, but there are other examples of urban legends, or even cryptids, where there is that sort of dimension. I mean, Andrew mentioned the racism implicit in the flashing lights urban legend. I mean, you know, you could extend some of the same basic assumptions to, you know, sightings of Bigfoot, for example, because then you start to introduce questions about, well, what is evolution and what is the relationship between humanity and the great apes? And, and even there, it's not a neat explanation, but you can kind of see how that can sort of be taken into a more sort of cohesive explanation of a worldview, you know, in this case, often with racist dimensions. But I think that explanatory power is the key differential between a conspiracy theory and an urban legend.
Again, we are talking about conspiracy theories today with Andrew Ferguson, with David Walsh. They are postdoctoral fellows at UVA, and they teach a class. There's so many conspiracy theories to talk about. Let's take our first break, come back. We're going to go through a handful of them that I believe are in the class, and then we'll have some more questions as follow-ups. Gentlemen, hang tight. Be right back. And thanks, everybody. We are talking about conspiracy theories today. Andrew Ferguson, David Walsh. They teach a class at UVA on conspiracy theories. So, gentlemen, I want to start jumping into some of the more famous conspiracy theories that are out there. We already talked about never landing on the moon. How about the world is flat? Who wants to take over and talk about that?
Sure, I could probably address that at some length. I've actually talked to some of the flat earthers before. I've given a paper on the Flat Earth Society at the Modern Language Association convention a couple of years ago about the rhetoric and the imagination of the flat earthers. And they're an interesting bunch because you would think this, above all things, is something that couldn't persevere into our modern age of telescopes and satellites that can take actual pictures of the Earth from above the Earth, from the Moon and beyond. But it's actually more popular now probably than it ever was. You know, this was once the ancients discovered or did the calculations to prove that the world was a sphere. This is just something that's been generally known for most of human history. Recordings of it, and it wasn't really until the middle of the 19th century that a gentleman who was convinced that became convinced that the Earth had to be flat because the Bible said that the Earth has four corners and the Earth can't have four corners if it's a sphere. Therefore, you know, our sense of cosmology has to change to reflect the literal truth of the Bible, which is a mode of reading that really didn't exist until around that time. And this was not certainly a majority opinion then. It never really was the majority opinion. It never really got any sort of support whatsoever, but a very small group of followers over time. And then once it hit the internet era, oddly enough, when the internet has networked the entire world and we can talk instantaneously around the globe, in just a matter of microseconds, that becomes the point at which we start seeing this prevalence of the world being flat again, and the flat Earth society, which had been a thing for 30 or 40 years or more, putting up a website with an FAQ, which is strongly recommended for your own entertainment purposes, and actually having conventions of people who are flat earthers, some of whom fly from places around the world to reach the Flat Earth Convention each year. And again, you would think this is something that couldn't exist in this day and age, and why would it even be a thing anymore? And the root cause of it really seems to be that a deep suspicion of our scientific organizations, a deep suspicion of received information, like of what you're taught in school, sort of as a big conspiracy to exercise power and control over you, that you would, if you'll believe this, and their big villain in this is NASA. If you believe this, if you believe NASA's lies, then you'll believe anything. So they have this control built into the system. I say that, the flat earthers are sort of interesting there. They're not completely harmless, certainly, from the point of view of, they have been infiltrated by anti-Semitism. There's certainly built into it some aspects of racism and eugenics thought, but they're not as overtly so as many other very heavily online conspiracy theories. They also believe in, they say we have to believe, in fact, the received wisdom on climate change. They're very intent on climate change and are often very activist about the need to combat climate change. And I think ultimately the reason is a lot of these flat earthers, their picture of the world is of a flat plane bounded around on a disk by an ice wall, that what we see as Antarctica on our global models is actually an ice wall that rings around the Earth. And, when in climate change, we're already seeing melting of the glaciers and stuff like that. But if you have an ice wall around the entire Earth and that melts, it's going to be that much worse. So on a flat Earth, climate change is an even greater threat to our livelihood than we would already believe it to be. But I do think it's interesting, as we've talked earlier about the moon landings, and then we talked now about the flat Earth societies, we're sort of pushing against the outer boundaries, what most people would put beyond the pale of contemporary thinking. And I don't know if you had any other, what other sort of conspiracies you might be interested in that hit a little bit closer to home, or things that, that people might harbor some sorts of doubts about, or even things that are historically like real conspiracies that we know have had documented effects on the world, if there are any of those that you were curious about.
Well, that's one of my questions is, have there ever been any conspiracy theories that have been proven true? I mean, we talk about the Kennedy assassination, and there was, that's not just people forming groups and meeting. That was actually a government committee who got together, correct? To prove whether they were trying to prove that it was James Earl Ray, Lee Harvey Oswald, but wrong shooter for wrong assassination, but didn't they get together to prove that they had the person who did the crime?
I think you're referring there to the Warren Commission, which was convened in 1964, shortly after the Kennedy assassination, to sort of go over the facts of the case. And they concluded that Lee Harvey Oswald was the lone shooter and acted alone in the Kennedy assassination. And obviously there have been a lot of conspiracy theories about the Kennedy assassination over the years. I mean, infamously, Jim Garrison, who was the district attorney in New Orleans, prosecuted, turned into an Oliver Stone film in the 90s, prosecuted a local businessman named Clay Shaw, who he claimed was a CIA agent named Clay Bertram, who had organized anti-Castro Cubans to assassinate Kennedy with the assistance potentially of the CIA and the U.S. military. And, you know, the Oliver Stone movie JFK basically blames the military-industrial complex for killing Kennedy, which I've always found to be pretty laughable, considering that Kennedy, contrary to, I think, to his reputation today, was in fact a very much a Cold War hawk. He was intensely, militantly anti-communist, anti-Soviet. This idea that Kennedy was going to that Kennedy was assassinated to prevent the escalation of the war in Vietnam, which is the thesis of the Oliver Stone film, and still very popular among JFK conspirators to this day, is pretty, speaking as a historian, is pretty laughable. But the Warren Commission, I mean, the interesting thing about the Warren Commission is that they did take, seriously is maybe too strong of a word, but they did entertain all sorts of implausible and fantastical explanations for the JFK assassination. My personal favorite is from the John Birch Society, which was an extreme right-wing organization at the time. I mean, they're technically still around, but they were a mass membership organization in the early 1960s. I think they had about 100,000 people in 1964. And in their magazine, a University of Illinois classics professor had written a very deep – his name is Revilo Oliver, which is a palindrome. It's such a bizarre name. He's a fascinating figure. But he wrote a 5,000-word-long article called Marksmanship in Dallas, spelled M-A-R-X, in which he said that John F. Kennedy was a member of the secret international communist conspiracy who was assassinated by the communists for failing to deliver the United States into the communist camp fast enough. And he was called to testify in front of the Warren Commission for penning that article. So there were all sorts of very unorthodox alternatives that the Warren Commission and subsequent government commissions around the JFK assassination did entertain. They all concluded, however, that Oswald almost certainly acted alone and was almost certainly not part of a broader conspiracy. That being said, you know, as you said, there are real government conspiracies that have occurred in the past. You know, obviously, we can maybe talk more about some more recent ones, but since we're on the 1960s, I mean, the Nixon administration was absolutely rife with secret plots and conspiracies. There's obviously Watergate, which we could spend an entire program talking about. But, you know, there was another example of sort of the duplicity of the Nixon administration and Richard Nixon personally was in 1968 when Nixon, for all intents and purposes, committed treason in sabotaging peace talks between the U.S., North Vietnam, and South Vietnam in order to win the presidential election. So the story basically is that LBJ the Johnson administration was participating in peace talks with these governments. There was a breakthrough in October 1968, shortly before the election. Nixon got wind of this and knew that if there was a peace deal right before the election, it would be this October surprise that would cripple his chances of winning the presidency. So through an intermediary, he instructed the South Vietnamese government to basically stall and sabotage the talks because under a Nixon administration, he would give them a better deal. And this happened. There's documented evidence of this happening. And the South Vietnamese government did do this. And the war continued until 1973. There are real conspiracies that do happen and that do have profound geopolitical impact. So this sort of post-Watergate, you know, we talked a little bit earlier about this post-Watergate distrust of the government and of just the sort of perceived wisdom or received wisdom in society. It doesn't come from nowhere. It's based in this very real history.
Have any of the more I'll use the word famous, whether that's the correct word to use or not. Have any of the more famous conspiracy theories ever been proven true in any sense?
I guess it certainly depends on how you're defining famous in that sense. I mean, certainly there are, you know, again, there are very many conspiracies that are being carried out, you know, often, you know, by our own government that are they didn't want to be make them famous at all, but they've proven so in retrospect, such as COINTELPRO, where they were infiltrating, you know, supposed groups with radical politics and trying to bring them down from the inside. That was initiatives run on various sides, both by the FBI and CIA and various policing organizations around the country. These are things that are very historically documented by the various groups of papers, but the CIA office break-in that was carried out during a boxing heavyweight match, where those documents testify to the truth of many of the things that were undertaken. And we regard JFK in the 60s maybe as a watershed moment because the doubts placed by the JFK assassination and then picked up in the 70s by the Watergate break-in and many other high-profile assassinations that are happening at the time of MLK Jr., of Malcolm X, of RFK, quite a few others besides, of Fred Hampton in Chicago. But it wasn't just before then. This is obviously goes back quite a ways. You know, we were demonstrably interfering in various governmental coups and things well back, you know, even before World War II. We were interfering in the Russian Revolution, but after World War II, we were interfering in Guatemala and Iran, in Egypt and in Italy, and just so many different places around the world. And again, these are all, as I would say, like demonstrable historical facts. I don't know if those are exactly the sort of, you know, famous conspiracies that we think about. You know, they're not like the same type of alien abduction sort of conspiracies, Area 51 ones, which also have a lot of Cold War roots to them. They're not quite the JFK assassination ones, or again, as we've talked about, you know, these other ones today already. You might think about something as a demonstrable historical conspiracy, something like the Tuskegee Project, where various African American laborers were told they were participating in an experiment where they were told their blood would be tested, and in fact it was actually to test the results of just watching syphilis ravage bodies that were not given easily available treatment for those things. So it was, at its roots, it was a scientific conspiracy to carry out one experiment while misinforming the subjects, who were, again, poor black sharecroppers, most of them, and just watched so many of them die. And the survivors eventually received reparations and apologies from the government many years after the fact. But that's something that has done irreparable harm to the reputation of the scientific community, in many circles around the country, and still leads to this day to a sort of hesitancy for vaccine campaigns and other public health measures. So, I mean, there are certainly, yes, there are a huge variety of very legitimate conspiracies that aren't just theorized, but documented historical fact.
That's one of the things that I believe I read in the description for your class, is that when there's a conspiracy theory that each side says, you're wrong, that's what they want you to think. And so how do two sides come together, if possible, or, what is the discussion to have about that?
Well, I mean, I think that it's an interesting question, because I think that part of what we're trying to do with the class is to really talk about the ways in which conspiracy sort of feeds on conspiracy, and that this is a sort of iterative process, and that there are political intentions behind a lot of the more esoteric conspiracy theories, and you know, there's a lot of evidence to kind of sift through when thinking about this. So Andrew mentioned, for example, the U.S. intervention in the Russian Revolution in 1917, 1918, 1919. It's through that intervention that is actually how the infamous anti-Semitic tract, the Protocols of the Learned Elders of Zion, which purports to show this international Jewish conspiracy to control the world, was actually a forgery created by the Tsarist government in Russia in the early 1900s, itself probably a ripoff of an earlier French document. That's how it was first introduced in into the United States. Basically, American officers in Russia asked their white Russian anti-communist counterparts, how did the Bolshevik Revolution happen? And they said, well, it was the Jews, and they gave them this document. And it was translated into English. It was actually investigated as part of a congressional hearing in 1919 on the origins of the Bolshevik Revolution and the potential for the outbreak of communist revolution in the United States. And it was pointedly racist, too, pointedly anti-Semitic. There was a lot of concern in the army at the time that Russian Jewish radicals in New York would try to overthrow the government, at least locally, and establish some sort of communist regime in the city. One of the intelligence officers who was responsible for sort of writing the report on this, his name was John B. Trevor. He was later instrumental in establishing the immigration quota system that was passed into law in 1924, specifically to exclude Southern and Eastern Europeans from entering the United States, Italian Catholics and Eastern European Jews. And, of course, this has spillover effects, ripple effects throughout history, right, because this is a big reason why Jewish refugees aren't able to come to the United States in the 1930s and 1940s. So, another example of the kind of sort of deliberate political intention of conspiracy theories and how they're iterative. There was a Holocaust denier who was active in Canada named Ernst Zundel. He was a German, emigrated to Canada in the 1950s or 60s. I forget the precise dates. But anyway, he was a neo-Nazi. He realized that there was a certain sort of limit on the purchase he could get by just publishing Holocaust denial pamphlets. So in the late 1970s, he wrote a book called UFOs, Nazi Secret Weapon. This is the height of the UFO conspiracy theory craze in the late 70s, in which he said that UFOs were actually, or flying saucers, were invented by Nazi Germany during World War II. They were a secret weapon that were not really able to be deployed against Allied bombers. But, you know, the Germans were on the cusp of winning the war before there was, before the Russians overran them. He claimed that Hitler fled to a secret UFO base. This all turned out, basically Zundel later admitted that he didn't believe any of this, that the reason that he was saying all of this is that it would get him invited on radio and TV, and then he'd be able to talk for, 10, 15 minutes about how UFOs were a Nazi secret weapon. But then he later said, oh, well, then we could talk about, what I really wanted to talk about, which is that the Holocaust never happened. That if you believe UFOs were a Nazi secret weapon, it doesn't take you that much more to kind of push you to thinking other, much more pointedly political conspiracy theories like Holocaust denial.
Amazing. Our guests today, David Walsh and Andrew Ferguson from UVA, they're postdoctoral fellows, have a class on conspiracy theories. We'll be right back with more conspiracy theories for you to listen to. Hang tight. And thanks for being with us today, Sunday morning wake-up call. David, Andrew, I don't know who wants to take this on, but when you look at the conspiracy theories, and whether it's, I think one of you used the word outliers when we talked about flat earth society or never actually landing on the moon versus some of the ones that were a lot closer to truth or proven true, like Watergate. There's always this thought when you just talk about conspiracy theories as just this phrase that these are people who are foolish or uneducated, but that's not really true, is it?
I wouldn't say so. No, not at all. You can even look at, if even something so recent a phenomenon as QAnon, among the ranks of those people are of the believers in QAnon are very many, successful businessmen, people with graduate degrees, in some cases PhDs in their field. These are a cross section of society that you might be surprised how much it would resemble any cut that you would take across a cross section of the society, except maybe I think probably like a higher average income would be the one expectation I would have in such a survey. But I don't think that anybody is by nature, less intelligent for falling for a conspiracy theory. I think we all have the conspiracy theory out there that has our name on it, or the one that might be enticing to us. And you also get to down to it when you start looking into some of it and seeing the historical record and the kinds of things that have been done and historically documented. Some of the other stuff sounds a little bit more plausible. And I think that lends credence to even those things that are outliers, but definitely the things that are a little bit more reasonable to the average person. If you just ask them, they would be more likely to believe it with a historical knowledge of the background of the types of events that you actually do see looking into the record. I don't know, David, what do you think?
No, I mean, I completely agree. I mentioned just a few minutes ago, Revealo Oliver, who wrote that article accusing Kennedy of being a communist, and that's why he was assassinated. I mean, that guy had a PhD in classics from the University of Illinois. He was, by all accounts, one of the brilliant, most brilliant scholars of Sanskrit literature, one of the sort of ancient Indian languages in the United States in the 20th century. We were talking in class the other day about how so many sort of highly educated prominent individuals become leaders in the neo-Nazi movement, which almost by definition requires subscribing to out there conspiracy theories about Jewish control or of the media and stuff like that. William Luther Pierce, who was the author of the Turner Diaries, who was also one of Revealo Oliver's disciples, he had a PhD in I believe it was electrical engineering. It might have been aerospace engineering, but he taught at the Oregon State University, or it might have been the University of Oregon, in the 1960s before becoming a sort of a professional white supremacist. So it's not just simply the crazies or deranged who believe in conspiracy theories. This is a very, very almost sort of universal impulse in so many people. I mean, I think we can even see this closer to home today. I mean, obviously there's QAnon, as Andrew mentioned, but there's also the conspiracy theories surrounding Jeffrey Epstein and his death, which. Without getting into all of that, it's a subject that attracts a variety of different and very very sort of vehement views from just across the sort of political spectrum, from across the social spectrum, from people with advanced degrees, from people with high school educations. It's not easy to pin down. You can't just sort of segment a sector of the population and say this is the group of people that is most prone to conspiracy theorizing. It's much more totalizing than that.
Are there effects either both to a person or to society from belief in conspiracy theories?
Sure, I would think. There's quite a few, but perhaps maybe along the lines in terms of effects, sociocultural ones, political ones, that as conspiracy theories become a more dominant mode of explaining the events around us, which means that more traditional narratives about how the world works are breaking down or are found to be incompatible with people's lived experiences, which you can definitely see how how people might look at sort of the narrative of the American dream or something like that. And in the midst of, you know, if you're in a county that's caught in an opioid crisis or something, you know, wonder what happened to that, because it doesn't seem a working narrative for you anymore. But as you see conspiracy theories becoming more prevalent in explanation, I think you just have a general breakdown of authority, as people are going to doubt any narrative that they're given, you know, including however well-intentioned they are, is going to just be met with some surface resistance. But I think also you have, you know, we tell our students pretty regularly, you know, a thing that we're monitoring is just this breakdown in epistemology, which is, you know, that the study of how we know things. Like, how do we know what we know? Do we have a standard that people across the board can agree to? Yes, we know this fact is true. We know this fact is true. We can agree on these facts, even if we disagree on the interpretation of them. And I don't think that we have that anymore. I don't think that we have epistemological agreement even on what facts are or how facts are to be used, or what interpretation is in this case. It's a divide that's very real and very concerning, and it's somewhat difficult to see how to bridge back across that when we have these different standards of truth that are talking past each other, that really have nothing to say to each other on almost any subject.
Let me throw a few. We're down to the last part of the show, and I'd like to give you two or three different conspiracy theories to talk about, one at a time, of course. We briefly mentioned the alien autopsies at Area 51. Can you give us a little background on that?
Sure. I can go into that in a little bit more detail. So, this really, there have been variants of the U.S. government is concealing the existence of aliens, dating back to at least the 1950s. Although, in fact, some of the first UFO reports in the United States that were of sort of unidentified aerial phenomenon as such, date back to the 1890s. There was this great mystery airship craze, where there were reports of mysterious airships in the sky, like Zeppelins, in the mid-1890s, one of which supposedly contained alien beings from Mars. It's sort of a staple narrative in American popular culture. The specific sort of UFO crash alien autopsy thing, I mean, that comes from the Roswell incident in 1947. Andrew was talking earlier about the CIA's involvement in so many real conspiracies, and this is another example of that. So the what almost certainly actually happened at Roswell was that a weather balloon, part of a CIA operation called Project Mogul, crashed into the New Mexico desert. Project Mogul was an effort to monitor Soviet nuclear testing by using high-flying weather balloons to monitor for radiation at high altitudes. So it crashed in a sort of botched attempt at a cover story. The local Air Force commander issued a press release saying they'd captured a flying saucer, which, of course, sent this sort of media frenzy. And it eventually sort of became lore that this was actually an alien spacecraft that crashed. They initially released the true story without really thinking it through. And then when there was all of this media buzz there, the sort of firm hand of the government came down and said, oh, no, it was just a weather balloon. But so you can kind of see this dynamic at play even in this sort of story that's contained in 1947, right? It's sort of like modern mythology, right? Various new elements get added on over the years. So it goes from, oh, it was a flying saucer, to, oh, well, it was a flying saucer and they must have recovered the bodies, to, oh, it was a flying saucer, they recovered the bodies, and then they performed an autopsy, to, oh, they performed an autopsy and here's the film. And this became such a staple of pop culture in the 90s. In fact, we show an X-Files episode in our class, which Andrew can maybe speak a little bit more about, which just is about alien abductions and the UFO, the alien autopsy videos.
And I'll say real quick, I don't know if the you know, probably this audience knows the X-Files a little bit better than our student audience does, who did not grow up simultaneous with it. But do check out the X-Files if you have fond memories of it. Most of it still holds up.
Oh, I enjoyed the X-Files very much. So talk about Illuminati.
The Illuminati are sort of a stand-in for any elite that runs, you know, is supposed to run all of society. It's sort of, in some ways, it's a bleak myth because the elite is running it, but in some ways it's also a very comforting one to think, oh, we have a reason, you know, why we have such wealth disparity. We have a reason why, you know, some people are living, you know, these incredibly lavish lives while other people can't, you know, have to go beg on GoFundMes for insulin or, kidney transplants or whatever, you know. So it's sort of a myth that helps us to process how, it's on purpose. You know, this is, somebody planned this, the elites have planned this, and that's why things are going this way. And so that's actually one thing I think an Illuminati myth does. And there's big elaborations on it. You can see many entertaining videos on YouTube about how every popular entertainer is a member of the Illuminati and using pyramid signs and triangles and so many other things to signify they belong to this group. The Illuminati are apparently very noisy for a secret society, but I think it really just, the use of any elite in that sense, whether it goes in a specifically anti-Semitic direction, as many myths of that sort do, or it doesn't, again, it sort of stands in for our explanations of why we can't order our society in a more just way. It's that sort of question. And since, if you don't have that, if you can't ask that question, maybe you ask different questions, which is why do I never seem to have any money, even though I work so hard. Must be them. You're sort of forming a them in your mind.
I want to make sure we get QAnon in here because we've mentioned them multiple times.
Yeah, I mean, QAnon in many respects is just the latest iteration of a syncretic version of various different conspiracy theories that have been floating out there for decades, if not centuries. Now, I mean, one of their sort of core beliefs is this idea that there is this sort of a satanic international conspiracy centered on the Clinton Foundation that is obviously heavily involved in sex trafficking and all sorts of other sundry activities, and is also in some sense affiliated with, they have these ideas about, I think it's called soul spirit feasts or something to that effect.
Spirit cooking.
So there's cannibalistic elements. I mean, really, you can trace the root of a lot of these beliefs back to the 11th century with the sort of granddaddy of anti-Semitic conspiracy theories, which is the blood libel. The blood libel, I mean, it's ironic we're talking about this now just after Passover, but the blood libel basically is this idea that in medieval Europe that Christian children were being secretly abducted by Jews and ritually sacrificed, and their blood was used to make matzah for religious services. And so, I mean, it's a staple of, right down through the Nazis and beyond. You can see evidence of its influence with QAnon, although relatively rarely does QAnon ever go explicitly anti-Semitic, although Marjorie Taylor Greene, who is now a sitting member of Congress, apparently was under the, and also a QAnon supporter, was also apparently under the belief that what she called Jewish space lasers controlled by the Rothschild banking family, also a prominent feature of anti-Semitic conspiracy theories, was responsible for setting wildfires in the West. So there's that dimension, but there's also the satanic panic, the moral panic in the 1980s, this idea that Satanism is on the rise in the United States, and you can see it, its influence in a sort of a spate of child abductions and molestation scandals, as well as, of course, in popular music. You know, this is the era of, satanic messaging and imagery being spread by bands like Kiss. You know, can you really hear "Here's to My Sweet Satan" if you play "Stairway to Heaven" by Led Zeppelin backwards? That sort of thing. So you can see them resurface in QAnon, these same sorts of anxieties and concerns. You know, I mean, also, one of the aspects of QAnon which is interesting is links to your question about the Illuminati. It's this idea that you can explain very sort of broad and impersonal historical forces and processes by focusing on a secret, you know, elite or cabal. I mean, the Illuminati were blamed in the early 1800s for the French Revolution. You know, it's not these various interlinking social forces that cause revolutions and political tumult and unrest. It must be this secret group of conspirators. And that's basically how QAnon understands politics as well. It's this sort of hidden conflict between the forces of good, which includes, among other people, Donald Trump fighting the deep state, and these forces of darkness. And again, as Andrew said, you know, there's this idea that QAnon is sort of a phenomenon of the downtrodden. You know, the 1/6 rioters were you know, sort of the authentic voice of the American people. This is especially prominent narrative in QAnon circles. And when you look at the evidence, that's not really the case. People flew on private jets to go to the Capitol and participate in the violence and mayhem there. So it's weirdly enough, it's a conspiracy theory about elites that is being driven in many respects by other elites.
So quick question, 30 seconds. What are the two most popular conspiracy theories in your class? Just tell me the titles and we'll finish up.
The CIA, the birds are a CIA invention.
Yeah, the birds aren't real. And then let's see. I think I'll go with one that's come up before, which is that trees aren't real, which is a development of the Flat Earth Society. So neither birds nor trees actually exist in the ways we think they do. I like to say Finland isn't real.
Amazing. Well, gentlemen. Andrew Ferguson, David Walsh, they have a class at UVA on conspiracy theories. There's so much more to talk about. I hope that we can have you back in the future. Please return one day in the future to the show.
Yeah, would love to. Thanks for having us on. I appreciate it.
Take care, and we'll see everybody next Sunday.
Thank you so much.
This has been the Sunday Morning Wake Up Call on Real Oldies 97.9 The Wren. The Wake Up Call is produced by Dan Gould. Show archives can be found at cvillepodcast.com. Be sure to join Rick next Sunday morning at 11 a.m. for The Wake Up Call, only on 97.9 The Wren.